From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, when the Ku Klux Klan came to Texas, how the white supremacist terror group infected every level of authority from the courthouse to the jailhouse to the schoolhouse, and the man who broke their hold.
You had chapters who really were dominated by the riffraff and the people who wanted to do something violent. That was the whole idea, right?
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Southern Poverty Law Center ranks Texas as third in the nation for the most hate groups. The state has up to 55 hate groups amid a two-year surge in membership in the so-called alt-right organizations. But Texas and hate groups have a long history. And the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Texas is told in the new book, $10 to Hate, The Texas Man Who Fought the Klan. Author Patricia Bernstein tells us that in the early 1920s, the number of Americans who were members of the Klan was in the millions.
Minimally, between 1 and 3 million American men joined the Ku Klux Klan. And it was not just in the Deep South. It was all over the country.
You write that Texas was the stronghold for the Klan.
Well, it was in the beginning. It was the first big stronghold. But Klan fever tended to sort of roll over states in kind of random order. I mean, you would have thought it would have been Georgia where they started in Atlanta. It would have been Alabama, Mississippi. But certain states would get it, and then they would go through the phase and sort of go through the growth and the fall off, and then maybe another state would get it. But Texas was the first state to really be completely and thoroughly infected by the Klan.
What did that mean, that the Ku Klux Klan had infected Texas?
Well, you know, we think of it, everybody thinks of the Klan as being primarily a racist, a white supremacist organization, and of course it is very much that. But the Klan of the 1920s was also violently anti-Semitic, anti-immigrant, and most of all, and this is a little surprising to people, anti-Catholic. Plus, they set themselves up as a moral arbiter. They were going to straighten out cities and towns and clean them up and do things that law enforcement couldn't do. And you have to remember that after World War I, it was a time of a lot of social upheaval. Prohibition went into effect, and that led to a huge uptick in crime. And then you had social mores changing very rapidly. You had women who had the vote now cutting off their hair, cutting off their dresses, throwing away their corsets, and doing amazing, awesome, scary things like smoking and drinking and wearing makeup in public and going to speakeasies and trying out bathtub gin. And then you had all the new scandalous movies and music and dances. And the car really changed things too. So couples were no longer courting on the front porch swing. They were in cars parked on forested roads. So the Klan was going to take care of all this. They were going to get rid of the bootleggers and the moonshiners and the vagrants and the gamblers and the wife beaters and adulterers and abortionists. They had a whole long menu of people they planned to deal with. Lots and lots of white people. And that is also a shock. A lot of historians think that the Klan of the 20s actually went after and attacked more whites than blacks. I don't know if that's true because probably a lot of attacks against African Americans just never got reported. But I do know the worst violence was against African Americans still. There was a Houston dentist who was castrated, and there was a young bellboy who worked for the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas and was caught in a room with a white woman, which was not uncommon because one of the bellboy's duties in those days was to provide women of easy virtue, as they used to call them, for the traveling salesmen and so on. And they took him out to this post they had, whipping post, in the Trinity River bottom. And after they finished whipping him, somebody drew the letters KKK on his forehead with acid. And there's a picture of that, actually, in my book. I was able to find an image of it. So it was pretty comprehensive. But beyond the violence, which was very bad in Texas, they took over local law enforcement and they took over a lot of municipal governments.
The movie Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith's magnum opus, tells the story of the rise of the Klan and it was a hugely popular film, showed for years at the cinema.
That's true.
Did that have a role in creating this is the second wave of the Ku Klux Klan. We had an initial wave after the Civil War, and there was Reconstruction, and then this was the rebirth of the Klan, and they were inspired by the birth of a nation.
Well, it presented, obviously, a very idealized, mythologized image of the Klan as the bold knights who rode out and saved pure white womanhood and restored white supremacy and put the blacks back in their place, even though they technically weren't slaves anymore. And really, it didn't bear much resemblance to the actual post-Civil War Klan, which was extremely violent and attacked a lot of Yankees, you know, like school teachers coming down to try to educate freed slaves, as well as African Americans. It was so violent and it got so out of hand that the imperial wizard, Nathan Bedford Forrest, basically shut it down in 1869. And after that, of course, there were plenty of vigilante groups who kept on doing the same thing, but it wasn't organized in the same way, and they didn't call it the Ku Klux Klan.
So the Ku Klux Klan is created almost as a scheme, as a money-making scheme,
exactly,
by Colonel William Joseph Simmons, Colonel for no reason at all, something that he just attached to his name. And
he had a lot of explanations for that, too.
And he has this great story of him carrying the cross up to Stone Mountain himself and slipping and falling. And then there was also a woman that they had who was instrumental in the packaging of the Ku Klux Klan and made it a commodity almost.
Well, it was commonly said by all historians up till my book that there were three figures who were important in the propagation of the second Klan. That would be Simmons, who founded it, and then these two people who were partners in the Southern Publicity Association in Atlanta, and that was Edward Young Clark and Elizabeth Tyler. But Clark and Simmons were basically ne'er-do-well con men who lived long lives and never accomplished anything else except to get in trouble in their whole lives. And I came to the conclusion that the only real force behind the growth of the second Klan was Elizabeth Bessie Tyler, who was, interestingly enough, the owner of a number of what they called sporting houses then. In fact, they call her the Queen of South Pryor Street, which was in the red light district. So here was essentially a madam presenting herself to the world as a champion and a spokesperson for the Ku Klux Klan and a protector of pure womanhood, etc., etc., and that was her background. But Tyler had always had this tremendous drive to make herself respectable once she made some money. And so, according to one account, she worked very hard. She was just a country girl with no education. She worked very hard on refining her speech and refining her way of dressing, and they said even though she weighed over 200 pounds that she made quite a striking appearance. She wore these old-fashioned black satin dresses with old Southern cameos and medallions, and she was described as being auburn-haired and blue-eyed and having a rosy complexion. So I guess there was some attractiveness to her, too. But basically, according to one account, she just really understood men and their frailties and knew how to use them all and get them to do what she wanted. And this was at a time when women weren't even allowed to join the Klan, that she was the powerhouse behind the whole thing. And it was Tyler who, when she recruited the guys to go out and sell the Klan across the country, they were called Kleagles, she encouraged them not just to depend on racism, because in some communities there weren't that many black people. So she encouraged them to offer a whole menu of bigotries that you could choose from. If you didn't hate black people, maybe you hated immigrants or Catholics, or maybe you didn't like Asians. But there was always some group that your animus could be turned against and fed by the Klan. And as one journalist said, she marketed hate as placidly as you would sell sugar or automobiles or any other product.
And you're right that the money poured in.
Oh, yes. I mean, and they found other ways to make money. They sold these very cheap robes at a profit that could have been made and sold much less expensively. And then they would try to sell you lots of other things, like lots of groups. You know, they get you in with one hook, and then they try to sell you a lot of other things. She was behind The Searchlight, which was one of the Klan publications. She started a real estate company with Edward Clark in Atlanta and eventually built a beautiful home that's still on the National Historic Register in the Buckhead neighborhood and owned two cars. So she was doing very well for herself.
So it was $10 to join the Klan.
That's right.
So that's where your title comes from, $10 to hate. And they divvied up the money. Everybody got a part of it.
She and Edward Clark got a pretty good percentage of the what they called the Kleck token, which was your $10. So that was really what caused the enormous growth in the beginning. Plus, she was a publicist. She was a professional publicist, and she set out to drum up some great new publicity for the Klan and got the New York Herald newspaper to do a whole series on the Ku Klux Klan and how wonderful it was.
And how they were going to put the fear into criminals and defend the poor little guy.
And they were going to cooperate with law enforcement. They had Simmons in an interview saying, well, we never do anything unless it's approved by local law enforcement. Well, sometimes this was true because a lot of police and deputies belonged to the Klan. But the truth was they operated completely extra-legally and without getting anybody's permission.
You also write that the Klan had an ultimate objective to amend the U.S. Constitution to give the vote only to the white race and also to restrict immigration. So they did have a larger goal.
Yes. But the problem was once they got elected and were in charge of running cities, for example, they didn't really seem to know what they wanted to do. Except, you know, get rid of Catholic and Jewish teachers, get rid of anybody in government who was Catholic or Jewish. But other than that, they seem to be kind of at loose ends. And it's really interesting to watch this happening at the same time that the fascist movement was rising in Europe. But, of course, I guess it would be fair to describe Mussolini and Hitler as at least sincere fanatics. The people who led the Klan, for the most part, were not sincere about anything. It was just a money-making operation. And what would happen typically would be kind of like what happened in Houston. They come in. It sounds like a good idea. A lot of the upper-class people join. Then they see what's really going on and what the Klan is really doing, and they drop out. And the Kleagles didn't care where they got their $10. They were willing to recruit anybody. So then you had chapters who really were dominated by the riffraff and the people who wanted to do something violent. That was the whole idea, right?
They had these whipping parties and tar and feathering parties, as they called it, parties. These were, you know, assaults on people. They would pluck them off the street. Sometimes they got the wrong person, and next thing you know, they're being whipped.
And, you know, it was pretty random, too. So it might be that you really didn't do anything. You just got crosswise with a local Klansman who didn't like the way you looked at him or something. And it was all based on rumor and gossip anyway. So the story that frames the whole book of this assault on this handsome young war veteran in Taylor, Texas, in Williamson County, this all was started because there were rumors that this 27-year-old guy was having an affair with an older widow lady whose family had been friends with his family for many, many years. And, you know, she was taking care of her five children by herself and trying to survive. And he was kind of at loose ends after the war and was a door-to-door salesman for the Real Silk Hosiery Company. And they were friends. So, I mean, just on the basis of a rumor and the fact that he didn't immediately stop seeing her as soon as the Klan ordered him to, they committed this god-awful assault and whipped him half to death.
You're listening to Texas Matters. We're talking about the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Texas with author Patricia Bernstein. The story in the book is about Texas in this era of a reign of terror by this organization, the Ku Klux Klan, that had ingrained themselves in local law enforcement, in the courthouse, and in the schoolhouse. Is that right?
Yes, and remember also there's quite a bit of material in the book about what the Klan did outside of Texas. And there's one chapter where I talk about a raid they conducted that went very badly wrong in the Los Angeles area, and a really horrific story, two young men who were torture murdered up in a northeastern corner of Louisiana. Those were just examples. And when these things happened, local prosecutors, some of them were brave and they wanted to do their duty and they tried to do what they could to punish these guys. But either they were acquitted or they were never indicted, or maybe they got a little slap on the wrist with a small fine, or maybe there was a prison sentence and then it was overturned on appeal almost immediately. They just couldn't get a handle on this until Dan Moody came along.
And Dan Moody was the prosecutor for Willacy County.
And Travis County.
And Travis County.
At the time.
And he was able to figure out a way to put the Klan on trial, not just for this assault case, but also the entire Klan.
Exactly. He's kind of like the polar opposite of Simmons, Clark, and Tyler. He's like Dudley Do-Right or Harry Potter. I mean, the guy is just such a straight arrow, you can hardly believe it.
It's like Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, but very young. You know, he was only 29 when this happened. But he had had to start working at a very young age. He was not, a lot of people think he was part of the Galveston Moody family. No, not at all. And yet, with all the hard work and as smart as he was very likable. People just naturally liked him. And he was wonderful in the courtroom. And so he was elected the youngest county attorney ever, and then Pat Neff, who was governor, appointed him district attorney, and the Klan threatened to run someone against him because they knew he was anti-Klan. I mean, his whole, the main principle of his existence was the law. He had wanted to be a lawyer from the time he was a very small child, and four of his uncles were lawyers, and he really looked up to them. And he just could not abide any organization that thought it was above the law. And then besides that, he didn't cotton to their bigotries. He had grown up with a Jewish guy in Taylor, Texas, who became his first law partner. And he had a teacher he loved in high school who was a Catholic immigrant from Ireland. And he just didn't understand the bigotry either. So he said, go ahead and run somebody against me and I'll beat him. And he did.
So the trick for Dan Moody was keeping the Klan off the jury. How did he do that?
Harder than it sounds, right? Because it was a secret organization, supposedly. But he was very fortunate in that, unlike in other jurisdictions, he had help from an anti-Klan judge and an anti-Klan sheriff. Now, for some reason, Austin law enforcement was terrifically infected by the Klan, right up to the police chief and the sheriff. But somehow in Williamson County, it just hadn't taken. There hadn't been violence there either until the flogging of Ralph Burleson. And that caused people in the community to take up contributions for the prosecution, which had never happened before. But they knew they were up against this very high-powered Klan legal talent. They ordered up the best criminal defense attorney in the state at the time. And they wanted to bring in more big guns to help Dan Moody, so they did. Think about, you know, Williamson County didn't have a huge population. It wasn't that hard for people to figure out who the members of the Klan were. So he managed to keep them off the grand jury so he could indict these guys. And then he managed, through very careful, insistent questioning. And of course, every time he said, are you a member of the Ku Klux Klan, the defense would object. But the judge backed him up. And he really didn't know until the end of the trial whether he'd been able definitely to keep Klansmen off the jury or not.
He also fought the case in the court of public opinion.
Well, he said that in the beginning there was only one reporter there, and she was only sending out about 100 words a day. And he said to her, I will provide you, at the end of every day, a complete blow-by-blow account of what happened, and if you don't want to send it out on the wire services, I'll pay to send it out myself. And so more and more reporters started showing up, and it started getting a lot of media coverage around the state. And then when he won, he became a national sensation overnight. In 1926, he was elected the youngest governor we have ever had at the age of 33.
So how did that trial break the back of the Ku Klux Klan in Texas as a mass movement?
I think one of the things that happened was it was a wake-up call to some of these folks. And they were thinking, well, gosh, it's not as much fun anymore if I could actually be prosecuted for joining one of these whipping parties or for participating in some of these activities. And it made people think twice. And actually, it really was the beginning of the end for the Klan in Texas. Now, it was still big and got much bigger in other states, and people are amazed when they hear that Indiana ended up being the worst infected Klan state of all. But like I said, it went in waves.
And it wasn't just episodic. I mean, it seemed like this was a sustained reign of terror. These weeping parties were happening consistently.
Oh, yeah. There were dozens of them around the state. Like you said, it really was a reign of terror. But by 1924, the Klan candidate for governor lost to Ma Ferguson, who was really just running as a surrogate for her husband, who'd been impeached as governor in 1917 and couldn't run for statewide office again. Now, that's a whole other story, a fascinating story. He was a very interesting and colorful demagogue.
So, but when Dan Moody, before he was governor, he was the attorney general, and he investigated Ma Ferguson and exposed the corruption through the highway funds. Another notch on his belt for him, showing that he was a reformer and somebody who was going to fight for law and order. But the thing is about Dan Moody is, as you get further down in his career, you see, I don't want to give him too big of a halo for beating up on the Klan in this court case, and because he, as you say in your book, that he was a racist.
Yes, that was very sad to me. And you know, it's not that unusual for someone who's a passionate young progressive when they're in their youth to become more regressive and more reactionary as they get older. And when he left the governor's mansion, he represented a lot of oil and gas companies and eventually even turned against Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal.
Dan Moody and the white primary in Texas, and how the attitude was that the Democratic Party was a private club and they could exclude anyone that they wanted from voting in the state. And so they were able to say, we only want white people to vote. Eventually, the Supreme Court got around to saying, no, the Democratic Party is an essential part of the democracy, and so you can't do that. And Dan Moody worked very vigilantly to try to make sure that only white people voted in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I say in the book that because of his early associations, he did not understand the whole array of Klan bigotries, and he was not an anti-Catholic or an anti-Semitic or an anti-immigrant person. But I doubt in his whole life that he ever had much, if any, dealings with African Americans who were on his own level class-wise, who were educated, you know, who were lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. And like most white men of that time, even those with good intentions in general, he was a racist. There's no question about it. It's, you know, it's very sad. You find out your heroes have feet of clay after all. But for his time, I mean, you have to admire his courage and what he accomplished nonetheless. I mean, this was a period when the judge in the case, they called him at home one night, and the telephone operator said, I think you might be interested to listen in on this conversation, which they could do in those days. And he heard the Klan leader in Austin plotting with the big-time Klan leader in Fort Worth to murder him. I mean, what they were doing was very, very dangerous. And he just didn't let that faze him at all in conducting these trials and seeing them through.
Here we are today.
Today, yes.
We're seeing a resurgence of growth in the Ku Klux Klan. And we see people who traffic in some of the information that's produced by the Ku Klux Klan in the highest office in our nation. When you're writing this book, what did you think?
Well, I started out working on it, David, because I thought it was interesting history that people had forgotten and didn't know about. And then I'm doing this research, and in the process, I'm hearing people say that immigrants are bringing leprosy and Ebola, of all things, into our country. And then you hear a presidential candidate start his campaign by announcing that Mexican immigrants are mostly criminals and rapists. And then, of course, we know what Steve King's been saying lately, the congressman from Iowa, I believe it is, that we can't restore our civilization with someone else's babies. I mean, the kind of conversation that's going on nowadays, which some would demean my concern as political correctness, but to my mind, we have fought for decades to get to the point where there were certain things you didn't say about groups of people that were ugly in polite company. Maybe you were thinking it, but it was no longer acceptable to say it out loud. And now it seems like we've regressed to an extreme degree. Let it all hang out. Say it all out loud. Be as rude and insulting and unfair to people as you possibly can. Lump everybody into a group and treat them like they're all the same. It's very, very sad. And then, you know, it's progressed from not just hate speech to hate deeds with all these bomb scare calls and emails to Jewish institutions and four mosques being burned down.
Vandalism at these Jewish cemeteries? I mean, that is just heartless.
It's just unbelievable. It's very sad. But I like to think of Moody in a way as an inspiration for our time, because he used two of the best tools to oppose this kind of evil. The law, number one, and number two, publicity. And the great abolitionist Wendell Phillips said the best way to attack an evil is to tear it open and let the sun shine in. Let people see it for what it is. And that's what he did in the Klan trials. But I'd like to say one more thing, if you don't mind, David, about how, you know, the Klan was very popular in the early 20s, and then it kind of died out because of all the scandals involving the leaders, including a horrible case in Indiana with the Klan leader there. But some of the evil that they did lingered on and on and on. They continue to be a model and an inspiration for other right-wing groups. And they played a role in passing the draconian Johnson-Reed Immigration Act in 1924. And see if this sounds familiar at all. They did not say, we are going to ban Jews and Catholics coming into our country. They said, we're going to set a quota for each country. So-called Nordic countries will be favored. We're going to reduce immigration from these southern and eastern European countries to a trickle. So there'll be very few Jews and Catholics coming in anymore, even though we don't say explicitly that's what we're doing. I mean, how is that different from what's being done right now? But the consequences were really dire and tragic. It was one of the big factors, that plus anti-Semitism in the U.S. State Department, that kept Jewish refugees out of the United States, even when they had family here and it might have been a safe haven for them, and contributed to the terrible toll of the Holocaust. And that was, what, 20 years, 25 years after the heyday of the second Ku Klux Klan? This kind of evil can linger on. And, you know, everybody says, well, the Supreme Court, that's what you really have to worry about because you can't change it. But other kinds of hatred, poison, and things linger on in other ways also. And in a lot of towns and cities, you know, the distrust and the discomfort between people who'd gotten along before that perfectly well lasted forever, really.
Patricia Bernstein is the author of the book $10 to Hate, The Texas Man Who Fought the Klan. It's published by Texas A&M University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.